Hi, Marco Werman here. Looking back on 2023, I'm so proud of the work our team has produced. It's always an honor to share this work and these stories with you. As we present the voices of the people behind the headlines, we do so with our listeners, with you in mind. And as we highlight the bright spots in our reporting, we think of you and hope that, as our listener Cameron said so well, they remind you that there is a full spectrum of experiences, feelings, and intentions on this planet. We work to ensure that listeners have a better, more empathetic understanding of our world beyond borders. So now it's our turn to look to you. As the end of the year approaches, so does the end of our fundraising drive. December 31st is our deadline, but we are still short of our fundraising goal. Our nonprofit newsroom depends on listeners like you, and every listener gift makes a difference. A generous donor has set a challenge match for us to increase the impact of each gift. If we raise $67,000 by December 31st, each donation will be matched one for one. I hope you'll donate today so we can continue to bring you the global news you rely on. Visit theworld.org/give to donate today. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much. After months of fighting, the army in Sudan is losing control of the country to a rival paramilitary group.
It is winning the battle, and nothing at the moment is seriously stopping it from ultimate overall military victory in Sudan as a whole.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, still no ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. Longer-term peace will be even harder.
Israel, if anything, will move rightward as a result of this and will be more reluctant to move toward a two-state solution.
We'll hear how that's been Benjamin Netanyahu's wish for a long time. And in Taiwan, political campaigning includes visits to temples to pray.
What did you pray for?
I just pray for, I wish I could get elected so I could do service for these people and speak for these people.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us. We're starting the show today looking at the latest with the fighting in Sudan. The Sudanese state of Al Jazeera was something of a safe haven from the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, but not anymore. In this video posted online, an RSF fighter weaves between boxes of munitions in a warehouse in the capital of Al Jazeera, pointing his rifle at the Hall of Weapons. The National Sudanese Armed Forces, which had been guarding the city, suddenly withdrew, faster than many of the civilians there, in fact. The collapse has sent 200,000 to 300,000 people running for their lives, seeking refuge elsewhere. Alex Duvall at Tufts University is a top expert on Sudan. He served as an expert witness in international prosecution of war crimes in Sudan. Alex, what do we know about how Wad Madani, the capital of Al Jazeera state, actually crumbled?
Well, what it appears to be is that the Sudan army is internally divided and demoralized and doesn't want to fight, while the RSF is not only militarily quite capable, but also is using its financial resources, its cash in hand, to bribe senior military officers to defect to its side. So the hopes that there had been for a ceasefire, for a freezing of the situation, for ameliorating the humanitarian crisis, these are all being dashed by this development.
Yeah, I mean, I'm seeing that the RSF has captured 4 out of 5 states in Darfur and control of most of the capital of Khartoum. What has the Sudanese armed forces been doing generally in the past few months? Have they been retaking any territory from the RSF?
The RSF has been fighting in the way that it likes, at the time and place of its choosing, and winning every battle. And what we have in prospect is that the RSF is actually going to overrun the entire country. Now, the RSF is the heir of the notorious Janjaweed militia, the Arab militia responsible for ethnic cleansing, arguably genocide in Darfur 20 years ago. And since then, it has evolved not only into a more effective paramilitary force, but into a sort of transnational mercenary operation, very capable, very ruthless. And the idea that it would take over the whole of Sudan is very, very frightening to most people.
Now, Alex, you mentioned a moment ago dissatisfaction within the National Army with their leader, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. So for his troops, the National Army, to evaporate from Al Jazeera state as the RSF comes in so quickly, even before civilians. Is that surprising?
The record that the army has had of surrendering in major cities, this suggests that this is the beginning of the collapse of the Sudan armed forces. They may entirely disintegrate over the coming weeks.
What about the refugees from Al Jazeera State and from the capital, Wad Madani? Where are they going to go?
Well, the ordinary civilians are absolutely terrified of the RSF. It has a terrible reputation for looting, for killing civilians, for raping women. And so these people will be scattering in all directions. We can expect some of them to be heading to Port Sudan, the major city under the control of the army. Some of them may head to Ethiopia. Whatever happens, it's a humanitarian calamity.
What is keeping the RSF from simply winning this battle?
It is winning the battle, and nothing at the moment is seriously stopping it from ultimate overall military victory in Sudan as a whole.
The U.S. had been involved in mediation of this war. Those efforts seemed to produce little toward drawing down the fighting. Where are mediation efforts at now, and how is the U.S. currently involved?
10 days ago, in frustration at the ineffectiveness of a joint United States-Saudi ceasefire mediation effort, East African countries held a summit and they pledged a more proactive peacemaking initiative. And they got commitments from General Burhan and from the leader of the RSF, General Hemeti. But there's been no progress on the ground. And the United States, frankly, has been doing too little, too late.
Why is it important to have U.S. backing?
The key backers of the warring parties in Sudan include Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. And these are all key U.S. allies in the region. The U.S. is really the only one who can bring these major backers of the war around the same table and get them to agree.
Alex, all of these troubling details, and yet this war is seemingly so neglected by the U.S. and the rest of the world. Why is that?
Well, 20 years ago, when there was a terrible war and mass atrocities in Darfur, this was on the desk of the U.S. president. This was a number one issue for celebrities such as George Clooney to campaign to save Darfur. Somehow, it just doesn't command that level of attention anymore. And I think that lack of attention is absolutely tragic. And unless there is a response at the highest levels of the US government, things that we feared 20 years ago are going to happen across the whole of Sudan and perhaps the wider region. It's a calamity, a needless calamity unfolding before our eyes.
Alex Duvall at Tufts University, a top expert on Sudan and an expert witness in international prosecution of war crimes in Sudan. Alex, thanks very much for explaining what's going on.
You are very welcome.
Across Iran this past Monday, drivers encountered something bizarre. When they pulled into gas stations, they couldn't get any fuel for their vehicles. Iran said a cyber attack was the reason for the nationwide disruption, and a hacking group with links to Israel is being described as the culprit. That's according to news reports from both countries. The World's Shirin Jafari has more.
Orange traffic cones lined the entrance of this gas station in Tehran on Monday. Drivers hoping to fill up had no choice but to leave. One blogger shared his frustration with his followers on YouTube. Fuel is available, he says, but the payment system is not working. We follow him around as he tries to find another station, but he's running dangerously low on fuel. In the end, he finds one station that has the more expensive, unsubsidized fuel, one that doesn't require a government-issued card and connectivity to online servers. He fills up his tank and is on his way. A group called Predatory Sparrow took responsibility for Monday's attack. Iranian officials and Israeli media say this group has links to Israel, although Israel generally doesn't confirm or deny its operations against Iran. Sina Azadi teaches at the George Washington University and specializes in international security.
We have seen since 2010, 2011, that the Israelis and the Iranians have engaged in acts of sabotage against each other.
It's like a tit for tat. Israel hits Iran's gas stations or rail network. Iran targets Israel's hospital system, as they did on Monday, according to Israel's National Cyber Directorate.
This shadow war continues, but without escalating to an actual conflict, which could be detrimental to the security of both Iran and Israel.
Amir Rashidi used to work at the IT department of a petrochemical company in Iran. He's now in Italy, working for a human rights organization called the Miane Group. He has tracked cyber attacks in Iran.
We are at the middle of war. I mean, it's no joke. The difference is people usually, they don't see it as they see like an explosion.
Rashidi says in recent years, as anti-government protests have grown, the government has focused more on domestic surveillance that has left gaps in its defense against cyber attacks. And that's not all.
Most of the people who are experts in this field, they are leaving the country. Many of my friends who were used to work together in Iran in the IT sector, either they left the country or they are thinking of leaving the country.
People like himself, in fact. A combination of Iran's worsening economy, high unemployment rate, and political suppression are all contributing to the migration of young Iranians.
And finally, sanctions are playing an important role.
The U.S. has sanctioned Iran because of its nuclear program, and those sanctions severely limit the country's access to technologies that can help it avoid cyber attacks. Rashidi says even if Iran manages to buy these technologies on the black market, it will find it hard to keep them updated. The head of Iran's petrochemical company, Jalil Salari, went on national TV yesterday and said services have been restored at most of the gas stations across the country. But people are still sharing videos online. Like this one, where a driver films the long lines at one gas station. The group which claimed responsibility for Monday's attack said in a statement posted online that it comes in response to the, quote, aggression of the Islamic Republic and its proxies in the region. It also said this recent cyber attack is just a taste of what it has in store. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Along Australia's Great Barrier Reef, tourist towns have been hit with some of the worst flooding in decades. In some spots, the remnants of Cyclone Jasper dumped a year's worth of rain in a span of 5 days. Even though people there are familiar with flooding, the impact has been devastating, says Stephen Miles. He's the premier of Queensland.
Queenslanders know how to deal with natural disasters, but this one is next level.
There are shocking before and after videos all over the internet showing roads turned into gushing waterways.
It's no longer the Captain Cook Highway, it's the Captain Cook River.
And then the Barron River waterfall outside of Cairns, going from barely a trickle to bursting. This kind of deluge has threatened lives, cut off towns, and forced evacuations. Dan Bateman of Cairns had to stand on a roof for hours in torrential rain before finally being rescued. He spoke to ABC News Australia.
We had to dodge fridges floating past, big branches. At one point, someone said there was a cow coming down the road.
A cow is one thing. About 150 miles south of Cairns, a crocodile was spotted in a swollen drain in the center of town.
Oh, he's having a whale of a time. Look at him, surfing.
Rangers captured the croc and took him to safety. Meanwhile, neither rain nor floods nor croc-infested waters are preventing some Aussies from getting a well-deserved drink at the pub. Stranded residents arrived by boat at the Hotel Yurimo, about 100 miles south of Cairns, for a laugh and a pint.
Go!
The place is now jokingly calling itself the Yurimo Yacht Club. The rains have eased for now, and floodwaters are receding, but about 35 communities across Queensland remain cut off. Power and water service have yet to be fully restored, and officials say a full recovery could take months. Even as the war between Hamas and Israel rages on, the U.S. and others say that a two-state solution is still the best way to build a lasting peace. Just ahead, we focus on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and why he's worked for decades against a two-state solution with Palestinians. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. President Joe Biden says he's pushing for a deal to halt the fighting in Gaza and get more hostages out, but no breakthrough so far. Meanwhile, Israel's prime minister issued a statement today that seems unequivocal. Benjamin Netanyahu said the war will continue until Hamas is eliminated. Hamas has two choices, he said, to surrender or die. A new documentary from PBS Frontline gets into the political backstory of Israel's longest-serving leader. It's called Netanyahu, America, and the Road to War in Gaza. James Jacoby is a director. He's based in New York. I spoke with him earlier today.
In the early 90s, and this is in the context of the Oslo peace process, Netanyahu was emerging as the opposition figure in Israel. In 93, he was 43 years old. He was the head of the Likud party, the conservative party in Israel, and really made a name for himself at that time as saying, in opposition to Oslo, that a two-state solution, which is where Oslo was heading, was going to endanger Israel and Israeli security.
And the idea of a two-state solution, which again is on everyone's lips, I mean, Netanyahu at the time, what was his role in opposing it?
I mean, his role was really to oppose it on security terms. So we had, you know, at the time, the Israeli prime minister, former general Yitzhak Rabin. On the Palestinian side, you had the PLO chairman Yasser Arafat. These were two men that were sworn enemies that had only known war between them. They decided to put aside that sort of existential conflict and try to come to a political solution. And Netanyahu really never believed in it from the very beginning. A lot of people in Israel didn't believe in it, especially kind of hard-minded kind of right-wing conservatives and the ultra-religious set in Israel. They really thought that this was going nowhere.
Right. And a lot of people after Yitzhak Rabin's assassination squarely blamed Netanyahu for whipping up the crowd and opposing Oslo in such a violent way. He later moderates his stance on Oslo. How would you characterize the arc of Netanyahu's approach toward the Palestinians and their leader Yasser Arafat in particular?
Yeah, it's a great question because it was something that was very interesting to dig into in making this, which is that he had been a staunch opponent of Oslo. And then Clinton really tries to press Netanyahu to kind of go ahead with things. Netanyahu was really reluctant, but then kind of makes some moves, nods in the right direction toward peace talks, does do the impossible at the time and meets with Arafat, shakes his hand, and makes some concessions, but learns a great lesson because he's voted out of office in the next election. And that's because the right wing hated what he was doing, and the left wing also hated what he's doing because he was sort of, they saw it as slow walking the peace process. So he learned a couple of key lessons there, which was compromise is no good if he wants to kind of keep his coalition together.
Throughout this whole time as a right-wing politician in Israel, hell-bent on security for his country, there's also this parallel drama between Netanyahu and U.S. presidents. I mean, it seems there's always been friction between Netanyahu and every president, with pretty much the exception of Trump, certainly with Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. Why is that? What's going on there?
Netanyahu sees it as, you know, obviously an essential part of Israeli security is to maintain this special relationship with the United States, but he also sees it as a relationship in which he can speak back. He sees Israel's sovereignty as incredibly important and has always seen himself and presented himself and found that his political base really likes him to be in opposition, especially to Democratic presidents. And the Democratic Party and presidents in the past had been really pushing for a two-state solution. And Netanyahu had contentious relationships with Democratic presidents, especially with Obama. Obama came in really hot when it came to this issue. He really wanted Netanyahu to come to the table and to agree to going back to the 1967 borders. And there were lots of overtures by the Obama administration to Palestinians that hadn't happened in the past. And Netanyahu really bristled at this and fought back. And in part, his political coalition loved the fact that he could stand up to a president. In the doc, we show, you know, Netanyahu speaking in Hebrew to an Israeli audience, basically talking about the fact that, you know, he prides himself that he hasn't given away a centimeter of land. And the two-state solution was always premised on the idea of land for peace. And so that is his brand, and that's what continues to this day.
I'm speaking with James Jacoby. He's the director of the new PBS Frontline documentary, Netanyahu, America, and the Road to War. One of the people you speak with in your doc is a former Palestinian negotiator, Diana Butu, who says that the U.S. has failed by not making Israel pay a price in these perennially generous multi-billion dollar military contracts.
It's always just been one signal after another signal after another signal. And this is in an area that deals well with signals. This is an area that requires concrete action.
Why has the U.S. never acted on that?
This is an important question as to how the U.S. wields its leverage with Israel. And in speaking to people like Dennis Ross, a longtime peace negotiator and envoy to the Middle East on behalf of successive presidents, he's of the mindset, for instance, that sticks with Israel do not work. No amount of kind of public condemnation works, and also the withholding of military aid is far more complicated than just using leverage. It's an important military power in that region. There's other threats when it comes to Iran and others in the region, that it's a strategic ally for the United States. It's a very complicated question when it comes to, you know, what would it really mean to renege or to reduce our military aid to Israel?
And James, let's bring it up to the current moment. You begin your documentary with the arrival of President Biden in Israel after the October 7th attacks. And we see Biden and Secretary of State Blinken in a war cabinet meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu and his cabinet. Do you think that sent the world the message that the U.S. and Israel are a team in this war? And how do you think that perception is going to play out, especially as some are rightfully saying that Gaza has become a graveyard for children?
The film starts on the tarmac at Ben-Gurion Airport with, you know, President Biden 11 days after the October 7th attack arriving and giving Netanyahu this bear hug. And the bear hug having this sort of dual message of solidarity and caution. You know, we're your friend, but this message of don't go too far. And, you know, a lot of people are questioning in this film and in the world, you know, where has that bear hug gotten us? Were we actually able to use our leverage here to constrain an Israeli response? And, I think the proof is that we haven't been able to.
Do any of the people you speak with talk about how the U.S. should proceed at this point, especially with a prime minister who is emboldened to keep attacking Gaza and also has personal legal troubles?
The tragic thing always about this cycle of violence between the Israelis and Palestinians is that, you know, Israel, if anything, will move rightward as a result of this. It will move more towards security. It will be less trusting of the Palestinians at this point and will be more reluctant to move toward a two-state solution. So whether Netanyahu is still in power or not, and it's likely he'll be out of power once elections are held, whenever that might be, that there will be another right-wing government there that will oppose the peace process. And so anyone wishing for sort of a peaceful solution to this or a more sustainable two-state solution to this intractable problem, you have to deal with the realities of where Israeli politics are in the post-October 7th era. And certainly people are way more reluctant to trust in any sort of process now.
James Jacoby is the director of the new PBS Frontline documentary, Netanyahu, America and the Road to War in Gaza. James, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
This is The World. On December 20th, 1989, U.S. troops carried out a large-scale invasion of Panama. I saw the bomb falling, says this man, and the shooting that killed several innocent people. Years later, Panamanians are still asking the U.S. for accountability. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Spiritual, but not religious. That phrase might be a familiar one for you. A majority of Americans describe their own belief system in this way. The same is true in the United Kingdom, one of the most secular societies in the world. All this week, reporter Rebecca Rossman is bringing us stories from parts of the UK where she's been meeting young people to hear about their views on religion. Today, Rebecca speaks with some young Brits about some of the alternative spiritual traditions that more of them are turning to. Think mysticism, tarot, astrology. Rebecca recently entered the cellar of an esoteric bookshop where she begins her report.
In this dimly lit bookshop basement, tarot card reader Orlando Harrison is preparing a deck of 78 cards set to determine, well, a lot of things.
It'll just examine past, future, present position, ambitions and dreams, and subconscious desires in a sort of cross formation.
Okay, that's a lot.
I know you said basic, but that sounds like a lot to me.
With that many questions answered in less than an hour, it's easy to see the appeal. Harrison, who has been practicing tarot for 5 decades, calls it another form of counseling.
Unlike, you know, psychotherapy, where you have to embark on a huge long course and, you know, can be a very torturous and tedious process, I mean, tarot is very vivid and very immediate. Go through the pack. What I'm going to do is ask you to pick what's called a significator.
Call it a form of speed therapy, one that is attracting an increasing number of young people here in the UK. We are in Treadwell's, an esoteric bookshop in central London, which specializes in the occult. The occult, paganism, Wicca, shamanism, these are all loosely related forms of alternative spirituality.
Everyone's just grappling for the meaning of life, really. They're looking for it in different ways.
That's 31-year-old Coco Kaur, a bookseller at Treadwell's. Kaur says she got into tarot several years ago while working as a receptionist for a psychic reader whose clients included Kim Kardashian. Kaur says her interest in tarot morphed into a wider curiosity for the supernatural and mystical.
I kind of have always thought that there was something going on, so it's just searching for answers to kind of affirm that or go alongside that.
Today, Kaur describes herself as a loose pagan, a belief that the divine is with us in the natural world, as opposed to some far-off place. According to the most recent UK census, 74,000 people identify as pagan today, up from 17,000 just over a decade ago. And the fastest-growing religious practice amongst young people is shamanism, which involves a practitioner interacting with the spirit world through things like trance.
Yeah, it's really practical.
Linda Woodhead is a professor of religious studies at King's College London. She says belief in alternative spirituality and use of shamanic healers is more pragmatic than you may think.
They will literally bring down your blood pressure, and they will bring you mental calm if you're stressed, and they will, in the case of astrology, it will help guide your day. It will say, look out for this, that and the other. You know, it kind of gives you a framework for living.
Practicality aside, many feel these beliefs still do hold a certain stigma.
First thing we do is we're going to light the incense.
I'm back at Treadwell's with the shop owner, Christina Oakley Harrington, who is performing the shop's weekly purification.
Blessed be the vervain.
A Western esoteric ritual that involves purifying with 2 kinds of incense, salt water, and sound. Oakley Harrington spent the first 15 years of her professional life in academia, working as a professor of medieval history. In her private life, she was also a practicing pagan, something she hid from her co-workers. Because if they knew...
I would have lost my job.
You would have lost your job?
Yeah. It would have been deemed to bring the university into disrepute. I worked for a Catholic university.
Oakley Harrington says, had this happened today, things might be different, and that growing interest from young people is helping to destigmatize things.
Often when younger people come in, they'll say, I am drawn to this, I don't quite know where it's going to take me.
There's a big ecological element to these kinds of beliefs. With the ongoing climate crisis being a top concern for many young people, Oakley Harrington says it's no wonder they're turning in this direction.
There's books on exploration of ecology, of the spirituality of the trees, of nature traditions.
But above all, the explanation for what attracts people to alternative spirituality may be pretty simple.
What my religious life gives me as a pagan is the same thing that my best friend who's Catholic, that her religious life gives to her.
Which is a sense of being right in oneself and right with the divine, whatever that may look like. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman, London.
Our series about young people and religion in the United Kingdom is part of our Sacred Nation reporting project here at The World. It's funded by the Henry Luce Foundation. Tomorrow, we'll hear about another space in British society where interest in faith among young people is growing. That's inside the UK's Muslim community. You can find more stories about religion and nationalism on our website. That's theworld.org/sacrednation. In Europe, 2 important stories today that will affect migrants hoping to reach the continent. After years of debate, the European Union has made a landmark deal to overhaul its migration policy. Separately, the French Parliament passed a strict immigration bill today that's being celebrated by the far-right political leader Marine Le Pen. To talk about both of these developments, Camille Lecoz with the Migration Policy Institute Europe joins us. She's based in Paris. Camille, let's start with the bill that just passed in France. What is it going to do?
This bill has been in the making now for over a year. And, you know, initially it was supposed to achieve the challenge of irregular migration, how to respond to labor market shortages, and also how to better integrate people. What was adopted last night is a bill that includes a series of measures that have been part of the far-right political agenda for decades in France. For instance, national preference for foreigners who live in France legally and who will not have access to the same social benefits as French people. There is also this idea, for instance, of having foreign students pay a deposit to ensure that they will return home after their studies. That's a measure that has been, you know, very much criticized by French universities. And there is also this idea that access to citizenship is going to be reformed in a way to make it more difficult for people to become French. And that has also been a source of concern.
Yeah, I mean, Marine Le Pen has called the vote on this immigration bill an ideological victory. There has been a resignation already in President Macron's cabinet because of the passage of this new immigration bill. Where does Macron sit in all of this? I mean, did he support the bill?
Macron really wanted that bill. And I believe what he chose is that, you know, Macron and his supporters are ready to compromise on values, but also on the possibility to develop well-thought migration, asylum system in France. And in that regard, he was to pass this bill to show that this government was doing something on migration, to really, you know, say everything was up for discussion, was up for negotiation. And given that, you know, he needed to vote on the right, this has led to this move further on the right of the discussion on this migration bill. But I would say, you know, the spirit in France today was like the voters who supported Macron in the past presidential election against Marine Le Pen are really puzzled as to what that means if the bill was passed primarily by the ideas of the far right.
So that's France. As I said, there's another immigration policy story unfolding across Europe. That's the broader agreement made by the European Union, years in the making. What are the key changes to this agreement?
It's around always these two issues, solidarity and responsibilities, but also how to support the quick processing of asylum seekers and their return to their country of origin, while at the same time ensure their rights, ensure their protection, but also ensure cooperation with countries of origin, which, you know, is often missing and makes this return impossible to enforce.
So what are the changes now, just on a practical level, for migrants trying to enter the EU and for countries that are receiving them?
A key principle of this new pact is that it enshrines the principle of solidarity. We've seen over the years how fewer and fewer countries were willing to show solidarity in supporting frontline states when there were boats arriving. Now this solidarity is going to be mandatory, and that's a relief for a number of states that are, you know, on the front line. And I'm speaking here about Greece, Italy, or Spain. This solidarity can take on several forms. For instance, relocation of migrants. So that means when people arrive, they can be split between different countries. Financial contribution, operational support, so that when people arrive, they can be processed more quickly.
How do you actually mandate solidarity on this, though? I mean, how do you make Poland, for example, feel the same pressure for migration issues as a country like Italy or Greece?
That's going to be something that will be tested in the next years, because that's also something that now Poland will have to abide by. And so what we're going to see really in the next 6 months is how policymakers are going to try to move this complex legal framework into practice and really monitoring to ensure that all member states, including Poland, including Hungary, are contributing. And also, importantly, that the rights of asylum seekers and all other migrants are being respected.
Finally, what do you think these developments around migration in Europe mean for the future? With this news today from the EU and from France, do they flag the start of stricter approaches to immigration for European states?
We're definitely going to see more attempts to, you know, curb migration. The issue is that Europe needs migration. Migration is also going to continue. That's just a fact. And so really where I see potential is, you know, for us to reflect on how we can better organize so that we avoid people who keep losing life at sea, or the sense that foreigners are not welcome and that resources are not invested for them to integrate into European societies.
Camille Lecoz is the Associate Director at the Migration Policy Institute Europe. She joined us from Paris. Camille, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In Panama today, there is a national day of mourning for the victims of the 1989 U.S. invasion. At the time, Operation Just Cause, as the Pentagon named it, was the largest U.S. military operation since the Vietnam War. In the United States, the invasion was broadly supported as the liberation of a country from dictator Manuel Noriega, a former U.S. ally. But many Panamanians saw things quite differently. Victims of the U.S. action are still demanding justice. From Panama City, Michael Fox has our story.
In the poor Panama City neighborhood of El Chorrillo, the wounds of the U.S. invasion are still written on the walls. Do you see this? This remains a memory of the shots fired, says El Chorrillo resident Efraín Guerrero. He points to a bullet hole left in the wall from the invasion down the street from his house. Right here, there was a downed helicopter, he says. Overnight, on December 20th, 1989, nearly 30,000 U.S. soldiers attacked positions across Panama. The neighborhood of El Chorrillo was ground zero. This video was shot by a U.S. soldier during the invasion. El Chorrillo surrounded the main military barracks for the Panama Defense Forces. When U.S. soldiers attacked, they leveled entire city blocks. University of Panama professor Olmedo Beluche wrote one of the first books about the invasion and the toll. He says 20,000 people lost their homes.
Era como Gaza hoy en día.
It looked like Gaza today, he says. Officially, 560 people were killed. There may have been a few more. The Red Cross saw 2,000 people wounded. Resident Omar Gonzalez today holds youth activities in a park where the Panamanian military barracks once stood. He says he was 12 the day the U.S. invaded. His family had decorated their Christmas tree earlier that day. We watched out the window and we could see the bombing, he says. The wooden houses on the side of the barracks lit on fire, and we watched several innocent people die there, he says. Many were buried in mass graves. U.S. troops captured Panamanian leader Manuel Noriega and took him back to the United States, where he was imprisoned on drug trafficking charges. The U.S. installed a puppet government. Noriega was a polarizing figure. Many Panamanians celebrated his removal. Earlier that year, he had refused to recognize elections that would have removed him from power. But the invasion was another story. Since 2016, the December 20th Commission has been charged with identifying and confirming the dead and disappeared. The commission is overseen by José Luis Sosa, who's going through the archives, rows of files on the invasion and the victims. I ask him why it took the Panamanian government 27 years to launch a commission to investigate the invasion and the aftermath. I've always felt that there was a certain fear of bothering the United States with an investigation into the invasion. Fortunately, he says, we've matured and we have made progress. But his is not the only investigation. Only months after the U.S. attack, young lawyer Gilma Camargo launched a case against the United States before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. It took nearly three decades, but in 2018, that commission finally ruled that the U.S. was responsible. Panamanian lawyer Gilma Camargo.
The decision is marvelous because it recognizes the extraterritorial responsibility of the U.S. It gives compensation, monetary compensation for deaths and injuries, for food, for vehicles. And I keep on saying, from the first dead man to the last plate they broke in Panama, it's covered.
The ruling set a precedent. It was the first time victims from one country had brought the government of another before the commission and won. But the decision was non-binding. In other words, the United States has just ignored it, refusing to pay a dime. Panamanians cannot just ignore the past. Camargo says the invasion destroyed the country and its legacy is felt today.
It's everything that we're living now, the corruptions, the weakened institutions, the financial mess that we are with people not getting paid well and not getting health care.
Marches are held yearly on December 20th to remember the victims and demand justice. Pedro Silva is one of the organizers. He was eight when the U.S. bombs fell.
Sobrevivimos a la invasión. Sobrevivimos.
We survived the invasion, but others died, he says. Our work is important so that when you meet someone who didn't experience the invasion, you can say with clarity that this was an act of cruelty, an act of war. We cannot let this be forgotten, he says. Last year, Panama finally declared December 20th an annual day of national mourning. It doesn't change history or bring back the dead, but it's a sign of the country's slow steps to honor the victims and ensure that the past is not forgotten. For The World, I'm Michael Fox, Panama City, Panama.
In 3 weeks, voters on the self-governing island of Taiwan head to the polls in a general election. That means right now, campaigning is in full swing there. For the candidates, that means visiting some of Taiwan's many Taoist temples. It gives politicians a chance to show their spiritual side in public. The World's Patrick Nguyen follows one candidate running for office who's trying to sway voters' hearts, minds, and souls.
The temple air is hazy with incense. Dozens of worshippers clad in tangerine-colored robes are praising the gods. I'm spending part of the day with Zeng Poyu, a candidate for the legislature, and we're now at Taiping Temple. She's in jeans and running shoes, dressed like someone on the go. Zeng stands before a massive brass urn. Her head is bowed, her eyes shut, and her lips are moving. Zeng is praying, but it's hard to make out what she's saying over the horns and the clang of cymbals.
What did you pray for?
I just pray for, I wish I could get elected so I could do service for these people and speak for these people.
Zeng is running for Taiwan's legislature for a district in New Taipei City. She's with the Democratic Progressive Party, currently running the government. Following Taoist tradition, every time she visits a temple, like this one, she introduces herself, saying to the spirit world, "It's me, Zeng Poyu, 31 years old, and here's my address."
You've been introducing yourself to many gods lately on this campaign.
No, you have to do this because so many people make a wish. So you have to say who you are, where do you live, in order for them not to make a mistake when they are showing the miracle, showing like their power.
There are hundreds of gods and goddesses in Taoism, and they can make mistakes. They're not all omnipotent. Taoists in Taiwan believe in spiritual forces underlying the universe. Deities represent different forces, like love or benevolence. Some are like patron saints, favored by specific groups. Fishermen, police, or couples trying to get pregnant. Zeng often prays to a deity portrayed as blazing across the heavens on wheels of fire. His name is Taizi. He is the patron of truck drivers, taxi drivers, and those on long journeys, like running for office. But Zeng didn't always take prayer seriously. As a kid, her parents didn't raise her all that religious.
They go to temples, whatever gods they saw, they just bye-bye. It's kind of a tradition instead of a real religion.
To bye-bye is to pay respect to spirits or ancestors. Taiwan's population is roughly one-third Taoist, one-third Buddhist, with most of the rest, when polled, saying they follow no religion. But Taiwanese people don't fit into neat boxes. Many blend Buddhist and Taoist beliefs. Others might say they're atheist, but go to the temple and bye-bye if they're stressed. The pressure of campaigning is what drove Zeng Poyu to start praying in earnest. But that's not the only reason she goes to temples. In Taiwan, according to the government, there's a religious building roughly every square kilometer. Temples are like community centers where people hang out.
And when you go talk to them, when you go make friends with these people, they feel like you're an insider, you're my people.
This is why Taiwanese politicians go to so many temples. Professor Wang Ye Li at National Taiwan University says, unlike, say, many Christians in the U.S., a Taiwanese temple goer might not care if a candidate has no faith.
In Taiwan, it's just important for politicians to show their respect to the local temple. It's not absolutely necessary that they believe.
Wang says the important part for politicians is just showing up. Some politicians in Taiwan will claim that certain deities actually back their campaigns. The Taiwanese billionaire Terry Guo, founder of Foxconn, which assembles iPhones, has run for president twice, including this year. In 2019, he was surrounded by reporters on the street, asking him, "Sir, why are you running?" For Matsu, he said. Matsu is probably the most beloved goddess in Taiwan. Guo said she came to him in a dream, telling him he should be president. Professor Wang says politicians who lean too hard on their Taoist beliefs can seem insincere.
I can't believe they 100% in their hearts really think that they have the support of a deity. I think that it's an election strategy.
Wang says he doesn't think any politician deep down really thinks they have a deity's backing. They're just trying to get elected. Back at the temple in New Taipei City, Zheng Poyu, now that her prayers are complete, gets to work. She greets everyone she sees, temple attendants in bright robes, plus casual adherents dressed in street clothes. Zheng says hello to one of the temple chairmen named Liu Jinxiong. The chairman tells me, oh, we've had everyone come through here, the Taiwanese president, the vice president too. I ask if Zheng, in coming here, has picked up any votes. But Chairman Liu pushes back on that line of questioning. Every political party coming through here, he says, gets treated warmly. The temple never takes sides. And Zheng Poyu says that's totally fair. She's just here to show her face. This is the Taiwanese version of shaking hands and kissing babies, only she's lighting incense and exalting the local gods. But that prayer earlier, that was sincere, she says. To win this race, she'll take all the help she can get, even from the spirit world.
And how does it make you feel after you pray?
Usually you feel empowered because you feel like, you know, someone's taking care of you. So when you are running your campaign in this area, you feel protected, you feel taken care of.
And with that, Zheng Poyu says her goodbyes. The night is still young, and if she hurries, she can put in an appearance at another temple across town. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen in New Taipei City.
Journalist Michael Garber in Taiwan contributed to this reporting. Join us again tomorrow on the show for a special report about children getting cancer treatment in Spain.
Leukemia is a disease that can attack you anywhere. Mine started with stomach pains.
And cancer clinics in Barcelona, increasingly it's children from Peru who are the patients. Their families have run out of options at home, and they're finding a way to access the Spanish healthcare system. That's tomorrow here on The World. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. We'll see you again here tomorrow. Before we go, I want to remind you that we are nearing the end of our fall fundraiser. We have until December 31st, but we're still short of our goal. We won't get there without your help. Every gift will get us one step closer. Make your donation to support our human-centered reporting today at theworld.org/give. Thanks so much.